I get myself excited about my own message. Maybe I'll get you guys excited about it too. But if you find yourself falling asleep, don't, you know, I forgive, you know, forgive me for not being more entertaining. But here in Isaiah 28, it's a funny little thing here. Isaiah 28, verse 20, says this. The bed is shorter than a man can stretch himself on it. And the covering narrower than that he can wrap himself in. How many of you can attest to this or know what I'm talking about? Raise your hand. Heard of being short-sheeted before? The prison term where they would, the prisoners, they'd have a certain sheet that would fit them, and then someone would short-sheet them, meaning they would change sheets with them. And the prisoner would put the sheet on, and they'd be like, this isn't my sheet, because it is, and someone else has a sheet. Wherever he is, he took off with it, and he ain't giving it back. But also, I like to think of, you know those little love seat couches we have out there? Ever tried laying down? Where do your legs end up either going? Either in your chest or over the end of it. It's, no, not really a comfortable position. And as the taller you grow, you find that there are more and more issues for tall people as far as beds are concerned. Stretching out does not happen. Or find yourself and every narrower than he can wrap himself in. I remember camping this, we did that last year, right? Camping in the back of my, yeah, I was camping in the back of my truck, and I didn't bring a sheet the first night. So that night, I thought it would be warm. I had all my stuff set up. I had my striped jacket for my pillow and a towel, and it got cold that night, let me tell you. I did not sleep well. You know, the towel reached to about right here in my short jacket. Well, I'd either pull it up to cover it up, my feet be exposed, or I'd wrap it around my feet real tight, and then I'd be like, so the whole night pulling it back and forth, and I try to turn sideways. And then the next night, my mom had mercy on me, gave me a blanket off the bus. Apparently, they had spares on the bus, and I did not know about the first night. The bed wasn't shorter, but the covering narrower than the man could wrap himself. No. How many of you have ever heard of the book by J.B. Phillips? Actually, how many have ever heard of J.B. Phillips before? You, because it's the New Testament, isn't he? The New Testament that John uses a lot. J.B. Phillips is the one who authored that. But he's written actually a lot of pretty good books. One that I remember reading in Bible college was called Your God is Too Small. I'm just going to read you the introduction to it because that's probably as far as I read it. I think I had to read it for a school assignment, but I was thinking about it. I'll give this to you. No one is ever really at ease in facing what we call life and death without a religious faith. The trouble with many people today is that they have not found a God big enough for modern needs. While their experience of life has grown in a score of directions, and their mental horizons have been expanded to the point of bewilderment by world events, by scientific discoveries, their ideas of God have remained largely static. It is obviously impossible for an adult to worship the conception of God that exists in the mind of a child of Sunday school age, unless he is prepared to deny his own experience of life. If by great effort of will he does do this, he will always be secretly afraid that some new truth may expose the juvenility of his faith. And it will always be by such an effort that he will either worship or serve a God who is really too small and his adult guilty. It often appears to those outside the churches that this is precisely the attitude of Christian people. They are not strenuously defending an outgrown conception of God, Then they are cherishing a hothouse God who could only exist between the pages of the Bible or inside the four walls of a church. Therefore, to join in with the worship of a church would be to become party to a piece of mass hypocrisy and to buy a sense of security at the price of the sense of truth. Many men of goodwill will not consent to such a transaction. It cannot be denied that there is a little truth in this criticism. There are undoubtedly professing Christians with childish conceptions of God, which could not stand up to the winds of real life for 5 minutes. But Christians are by no means always unintelligent, naive, or immature. Many of them hold a faith in God that has been both pure, purged, and developed by the strains and perplexities of modern times, as well as by a small but by no means negligible direct experience of God himself. They have been seen enough to know that God is immeasurably bigger than our forefathers ever imagined. And modern scientific discoveries only confirm their beliefs that man has only just begun to comprehend the incredibly complex being who is behind what we call life. Many women and men today are living often with inner dissatisfaction, without any faith in God at all. This is not because they are particularly wicked or selfish or, as the old-fashioned would say, godless, but because they have not found within their adult minds God big enough to account for life, big enough to fit in with the new scientific age, big enough to command their highest admiration and respect, consequently their willing. It is the purpose of this book to attempt two things. First, to expose the inadequate conceptions of God, which still linger unconsciously in many minds, and which pervert our catching a glimpse of the true God. And secondly, to suggest ways in which we can find the real God for ourselves. If it is true that there is someone in charge of this whole mystery of life and death, we can hardly expect to escape a sense of futility frustration until we begin to see what he is like and what his purpose is. That was a mouthful. Now, who here kind of understood what I was talking about? Raise your hand. Yes! Alright! Yeah! I remember reading this about this and being kind of like, wow, that is very interesting. If my God does not grow beyond the outside of the concepts of what I learned in Sunday school as an adult, and in my faith, I'm going to be, you know, Sunday school boy. And, you know, that is beautiful in a sense because I simply believed in it, it was true. But it's for that age, right? And then we, as we grow up, life experiences, the whole world expands. And then with that, our theology also needs to grow, right? Concept of God needs to grow. It's not that God himself is limited. It's our understanding of who God is that needs to grow in itself. And it's not as though God cannot meet that need, but it's ourselves needing to grow in this adult concept of God. I remember reading this book and being like, wow, that is very interesting. But two of the points he brought up in the book. And first, let's turn to Hebrews 10:22. I mean, I think he brought up at least 24 different points, but these are the two that I read through and stuck out pretty good to me. 10:22, it says, "Let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience, bodies washed pure water, and let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised." The conscience. Can tell me briefly, what are the two operations of the conscience? What does it do? It accuses or excuses, commends or condemns. Those are the two basic operations of the conscience. It'll either say, yeah, Oh, go that way. Or it'll say, no, don't do that. That's wrong. Bad boy. It'll either say, okay, yeah, you know, this is. Or it'll say, no, bad boy. Don't do that. How dare you do that? Shame on you. How many of you experienced guilty conscience before? You should all raise your hands to this, because we all have. We've had it before in life. We do something wrong, and guess what? Yes, no, I knew it was wrong in the first place. Why did I do that? It comes in, nails you right in the guilty conscience. What's your conscience doing? You shouldn't have done that. Shame, 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 shame. Very bad, little boy. Very bad. Slap, slap, slap. You know, it gets us. Now, one of them was conscience. Now, if we are to live by conscience, we find that there is no love, there's no worship, and also there is no growth. And largely because of either upbringing, training, or the other one. I wrote upbringing twice. What was the other one? Oh, yeah, propaganda. That was a good one. Because of propaganda, upbringing, or training, that a person's conscience has been, you'd say, programmed. Now, here it talks about an evil conscience. What is that talking about? Because the conscience, isn't that good, right? Like, you know, God gave us moral consciences to understand what is the difference between right and wrong, between good and evil. We can weigh out what is good. We can weigh out decisions. We can say, this is a good decision, this is a bad decision. That's good, right? Right? Evil conscience. What is it that makes the conscience evil? And I looked up the two words. The evil conscience can be like this. That panaros is a word for evil, that it is full of labors or annoyances, hardships, pressed, harassed by, or bad in the sense of bad-natured or conditioned, or the physical sense or the ethical sense. Then we find out that actually in Luke 15, that a certain individual had this. Let's look at it. In Luke 15, the elder brother says this to his father in verse 29. And he answering said to his father, lo, many years do I serve thee, neither transgressed I any time thy commandment, and yet you never gave me a kid, that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this thy son was come, which had devoured thy living with harlots, you killed for him the fatted calf. The father said, huh. Ever with me, and all that I have is thine. But it was meet that we should make merry and be glad. For this thy brother was dead, and is alive again, is lost and is found. What did the older brother saying? First of all, this is the way he viewed his father. He just viewed him this way. Obedient, you know, bad, good. I have done that which is good, and I deserve to be rewarded for it. And this, my evil brother, what has he done? Wasted your living with harlots. And what? He should be punished, right? Now, what does the father say to him? He just blows that whole concept away. He says, son, you're always with me. Everything I have is yours. And then your brother, we thought he was dead. And he's alive. That's amazing. Praise the Lord. He's back. Amen. Praise the Lord. Let's have a party. He's alive. Everything is yours, son. These are such gracious words. Son didn't earn this by his good works or by doing what he thought he was supposed to do before the father. He's just saying, son, this is yours. Just like it was his, it's yours. Just the same way. But here the son, because of an evil conscience, couldn't see it. The only thing he could see was, I do that which is good. And because I do that which is good, I get paid for that which is good. My brother did that which is bad, and because he paid, you know, he did all that which is bad, he should get paid for all that he's bad. So he's what? Myself, commending myself, and shame, 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 shame. One of the things he brought up was that people think that God, and that's all he is. That's it. They just think that that's who God is. The one who tells me yes, no. Bad boy, yes, you know, good boy. Don't do that, yes, do that. And they don't go beyond that. They think God is just right and wrong. Touch this, don't touch that. Be good in this area, you'll be rewarded. Be bad in this area, and no cake for you, sort of thing. And that was one of the concepts he brought up, that it's just, you know, bad, good. And he said that that happens with, first of all, in that, there's no love. We saw that the son, he had no love. Love for the father, no love for his brother. There's no worship. That was like the older brother. That's a childish concept, right? The way he viewed life, the way he viewed his family and he viewed his father. Like, if I be a good boy, and I clean my room, mommy's gonna be good. A present. Isn't that why, Isaac? But if I be a bad boy, mommy's gonna shot my hand and I don't get a tweet. Now, what is that? I mean, we teach our kids that because that's good, right? But then we grow up a little bit, right? We grow up and we understand that there is a world outside of do this, don't do that. But that there is love and worship that comes into our life. Second one. Oh, yeah, there was the upbringing, training, and then propaganda. The one about propaganda, he said, like, during the time of communism and in Russia and then also in Nazi Germany, if you were a Nazi and you were a friend of a Jew, propaganda said that you should turn in the Jew. And that was good. Society. And if you were a friend and you felt like you shouldn't have done that, or you shouldn't, and you didn't turn them in, what would happen? Your conscience would say, bad boy, you should turn in that Jew, because that is propaganda. And that's what they thought. They thought that was what we were supposed to do, because that's what we heard. That's society. We were raised up, and, you know, Jews are dirt. They should be turned into the police and da 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 da. Propaganda. That's what he said, one of them there. The second point was an athlete. Now, how many of you ever heard this? 100%. As an athlete, you know, if you've ever been an athlete, your coach will say, what to you? Give 110%. 10%, boy, I want you to run that ball down the field as fast as you possibly can, and when you do that, I'll be proud of you. You'll be like my son. 110%. And gives him the best. Woo! That's your motivation. Woo! More of those. 100%. Like, okay, so the athlete, he gives us physically 100%. And he says, all right, you know what? I'm gonna live a good life. I'm going to do the best I can in life, right? Now, appreciate that. Athletes, they go out, they give 110%. They always expect more. 110%. But here's the thing. Like, we think God is the perfect God. But what is our idea of perfection? Really? Like, do we understand, like, what 100% really is in life? God is perfect, and here we are, human beings, with sin in our lives, trying to understand what perfection is. And we say, give 100%, and it's more like, I will give 100% how I understand 100% should be given. I will live the perfect life how I understand a perfect life should be lived, right? This conception of 100% in my estimation isn't exactly what 100%. Like an athlete, they give 100% according to how he understands what 100% is. But ideas of what really 100% is. Like, do we say, like, this athlete really understands 100% is in life? I mean, the only person I can think of that I get 100% in life was Jesus Christ. And I don't think I could do that. Right? Like, 100% Jesus Christ. That's, I mean, wow, look at that. Amazing. Like, and you know, if I can't understand one of his simplest sayings, how am I, in my limited understanding, going to live 100%? I'm going to give 100%, do my best for God. That's what I'm going to do. And that's how it's going to go. Now, where was I going to go from there? The conscience, that was two things from his book. Conscience, the propaganda, upbringing, training, and then also 100% athlete, the best I know how to do something. Misconceptions. of God. Now, from there, I wanted to... how many of you are falling asleep yet? All right, we got one, two. At halfway. Now, it's okay. You know, I'll try to be more into what I was saying, into what I'm saying, so you guys can... Now, who knows the definition of the word deficit? Deficit. Where's my phone? Actually, let me do something fun. I'll even hold it up to the mic. Deficit.
Especially a sum of money is too small.
Where do you got that? Okay. Deficit, the amount by which something, especially a sum of money, is too small. Now we're also going to try a different word. Motivation.
Motivation, the reason or reasons one has for acting or behaving in a particular way.
Did you get that one too? Technology, amazing. First I wanted to figure out how to spell it, and then it gave me the definition too. Reason or reasons one has for acting or behaving in a particular way. I remember a specific definition we had in Greater Grace. It was talking about the heart, how the heart is the seat or throne of all motivations, feelings, or decisions. But just one definition that popped up in my brain as they really seared into you there. Deficit motivation. Who has ever heard that before? Deficit motivation. Caleb, I doubt you've ever heard that term. Okay, let me read something to you. This is from No Nonsense Psychology. Go to sleep now. A guy named Maslow. He's very low. It's Mass. Deficiency versus growth motivation. Maslow theorized two different kinds of motivation. Motivation to satisfy a deficiency and motivation towards growth. What were the two? Motivation to satisfy a deficiency, and the other one was motivation towards. He came up with this theory of two kinds of motivation to explain the difference he saw between a psychology of sickness and a psychology of health. Maslow believed that the core of every neurosis was an unfulfilled need. If a person did not have a way to meet their basic need for safety, belonging, love, and or respect, that person would create a neurotic symptom to attempt to satisfy in some way this unmet need. He found that when his patient's needs were met, surprisingly enough, the neurosis disappeared. Now, who here remembers, that's not the end of this thing, but who here remembers the, whoever's read the booklet, Just Like God Loved You, raise your hand. Or at least the intro. What does it say in the intro? Come on, I know you all at least read the intro about need. This is the need of man. That was the first one. What was the second one? Okay, so what was the third one? Exactly. Wow, look at that. The intro. Hey, come on. Yeah, thank you, Miss Tina. Nick of memory, what was the need of man to be loved by God? Yeah. Anyway, I remember that because I read the intro at least. Maslow, though, was not interested in exclusively with why people became neurotic. Looked for answers to what motivated such things as a child's growth, healing after brain trauma, creativity, and even psychotherapy itself. Because there was something in people motivating them to move beyond their current situations into new understanding and new life, which could not be understood as maintenance of the homeostasis. So in brief, like he found out that people didn't just like staying where they were, which is what homeostasis is, just staying and, you know, kind of maintaining a natural balance, but they wanted to grow or, overcome something. He called this motivation growth motivation and used it to explain the tendency of people to grow. He saw this growth motivation as natural and foundational because it was exhibited in children and the joy they found in new discovery. And not only children, but also those individuals who he referred to as self-actualized. who continue to be motivated by the continuous joy of learning, exploring, and growing. I also agreed with those psychoanalytic theorists of the time, Eric Fromm and something, who believed that neurosis could only be explained in terms of a tendency toward growth, and that they were merely the patient's way of trying to continue to grow despite conditions which impeded their natural growth. This tendency for growth, he believed, was as important to understanding the healthy functioning of people as unmet needs were to be understanding the development of illnesses. Like grass underneath an inflatable pool, who knows what that's like, or anything you leave in your yard, which turns pale and grows sideways and outward to try and find the sun with all of its energies, humans, too, are constantly oriented to growth. The only difference is that we humans are not only motivated by physical growth, but also by mental, emotional, and even spiritual growth. Despite obstacles, there is a voice inside each of us which continually calls for us to become everything that we can be. Now, I don't believe this man, but what would we call that voice inside of us? Say, Jesus Christ. That's the Holy Spirit motivating us and moving forward to become like Christ in this life. Now, is it possible to know God? Raise your hand. Yes. Is it? How many of you say you know God in a way? Yeah. How many? I know God. Yeah. How many of you say you are still knowing God? Okay, I'm glad all of you raised your hand, because I was about to ask, you know, what's the secret to life to anyone who did not raise your hand, except for Joey. He didn't raise his hand. Joey, please explain to us everything we don't know. See what happens when you don't participate? You can see. That's only if I'm paying attention. Like, we will continue to learn about God our entire lives. And if you ever come to a place where you're saying, wow, I think I know everything about God, I want you to come and tell me everything you know, because I don't know. God is able to be known. And furthermore, our physical brains, there is no limit. I know sometimes, like in classroom, when a lot of information being poured into it, what do? Oh, my brain, my head hurts. I don't know if it can handle all of this. You know, we grab our heads because we feel like our head's about to explode. But actually, our minds, our actual physical minds, there is no end to the knowledge that they can store. Did you know that? Our actual natural brain, not talking about, you know, when we lose our bodies and when we're in heaven, our actual physical natural brain can never be filled up with information. Like, we could say that our physical mind is made for God. Not even in the spiritual realm, but our natural mind. What would you call this? This physical peanut-sized brain. Oh, that was maybe apricot-sized. Actually, it's amazing, astonishing. Like, there's no end. You know how you buy a phone, it has, you know, 16 gigs. 32 terabytes, whatever. Our brain does not have that. It is just unlimited ability to learn and to store and to process knowledge. Now, with that, where are we going? What is the motivation? Oh, yeah, the two motivations. What were the two motivations? There was deficit motivation. What did deficit motivation try to do? Or how did deficit motivation, what? Deficit motivation was when I have a need, I try to satisfy that need. That's a deficit motivation. I am being motivated because of a deficit in my life, and I'm trying to satisfy that need. Now, what was the other one? Growth motivation in life. And actually, many people start out in the deficit. Like, you know, you've heard testimony before. I had a hole in my life. I had a need in my life. Something was missing in my life, and I could not find it. And I came to Christ, and it was there. What was that person's motivation? It was a deficit motivation, right? I couldn't find it out, and I wanted to be satisfied. I came to Christ, I became satisfied. Now, after that, our motivation actually changes because Christ, right? Christ has completely satisfied us. When we eat a good dinner like we had tonight, pizza, what does that do? That satiates because we're going to be hungry, and tomorrow morning, maybe, actually probably 2 hours. 2 hours we're going to be hungry, going to go to the fridge, look for a snack, get some juice. That satiates because what? I have to eat, thirst, drink again. Christ satisfies in the deepest part of my soul. What did he say? My Holy Spirit will be like in you a well springing up everlasting life. Does that sound like a deficit to you? How many of you notice our water fountain is in working condition right now? When you push that button, what happens? You know why? The fountain. What? Because we're in first world. Yeah, that's why. We got water fountains. You push the button and the water comes out. Now, would you say that water fountain runs off a deficit? It has an unlimited supply of water, but it's, you know, supplied from the city or whatever. It's a fountain. Oh, inside of us, God giving up his Holy Spirit. You don't operate at a deficit. It's a growing thing. God has given us a growing thing. I remember teaching Sunday school to some Korean kids, and Pastor Brian Lange had this connection with a Korean church up in Baltimore. And I remember one of the lessons that got through to the – have you ever taught a Korean kid? Like, these kids are – I think their brains are, like, just amazing. I don't know if it's just because they're so intelligent of being Koreans – but it is, but I, you know, teaching these Koreans, because they wore me out. One of the lessons I think that got really into them that we could repeat over and over again is I took them outside because they were making so much noise. And I looked around on the ground because I was desperate, and I found a walnut seed on the ground. I'm like, okay, everyone, pick up a walnut seed. They pick them up, start throwing them at each other. Pick up a walnut seed. See this walnut seed? Yeah, see the walnut seed. Now, what do seeds do if you put them in the ground? They grow, because they all know, because the Koreans are so smart. This is the photosynthesis. You know, germination, all that. Okay, now God is like this seed. Oh, no. I remember, like, God is like this. He's in you, right? And he's right? Really, they start going crazy. This is going to be a tree. God is like this seed in you, right? You know, it's in you. And he's like small. Oh, he's big. You know, as you grow up, God inside of you. Out of the, you know, 6 months I spent there, I think that was the best one we had. What were we talking about? Growth. Where do we want to go here? Now, plants. Plants are interesting. Plants basically need, well, some plants, some are fungus. Plants basically need what? Three things to grow. What are the three things? Yeah, water, sun. Actually, I guess there's four things. And dirt. Okay. How many things do I need for this? So if you have plants, you can ask my wife about it. She has some plants inside her house. Succulents, because they don't need a lot of attention. I'm sorry, I'm ratting you out. Succulents, because they don't need a lot of attention. If she sees that one of her plants aren't growing, she gets kind of flustered with it. Like, what's wrong with it? You know, I put it out in the sun, I'm giving it water, it's not growing, it's turning yellow. What's the matter with it? The soil's fine, the water's fine, it's getting the sun, it's not water. You know, plants, they're pretty basic in how they grow. You know, four things right there. So, just sit on it, breathe it for a while, and then we found out the plant was plastic in there. So, I'm just kidding. But people. How do people grow? We grow physically. I was reading. I actually had another article, which was kind of funny, but I won't read it for time. I was reading about the development of people's minds, that a person's, an individual's mind does not actually fully mature until 25 to 30s. So I'm almost there, guys. Yeah. Hey, patient guys, I'm almost there. But it was interesting that they observed patterns in different ages group, that some were more and at certain stages, they were more, it wasn't risk, but they were more reward-orientated. And then at a certain stage, they were more decision-orientated. And then as it went on and on. And then also from the study, they found out that at age 15, Girls' brains are 2 years more developed. So, guys, I don't know about now, but, you know, just like, no, not everything, but at that stage of my life, I did believe it. Every single one of my sisters told me so. I'm smarter than you. Well, I'm stronger than you. No, you're not. Mama told me not to hate girls, but I'll make an exception. I'm sorry. But, I don't even know what we're talking about. Maturity of mind, body, health, emotions. We're growing, fully developed. Years 25, so, you know, don't worry about that. Interestingly, let's read 1 Corinthians 13. We as believers also. We can get to 1 Corinthians 13. It says this, 1 Corinthians 13:11. When I was a child, guess what I did? I spake as a child. I understood as a child, and I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. And this, specifically being the chapter about love, it's referring to love. Like, you know, it's very cute when your child says, I love you. But does he understand what love is? According to what you understand about love. Okay, you tell me you love me. Are you willing to stay up, you know, night and day when I get sick and take care of me? Are you willing to go to work and go make a living for the family, you know, fix food for me, you know, go shopping for me? Love you. All he knows is that when he says, I love you, it makes you smile. That's all he knows. Like, it's cute, but is it cute because it's child is saying, oh, but it's like, you know. Go find out what, you know, real love is. And then, like, there's the romantic love and the, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend. You love me. Oh, I love you. Oh, you know, I'll cross the highest mountain. I'll go through the lowest valley. I'll cross the furthest ocean. And by the way, it'll be over on Thursday if it's not raining. Like, you know, it's kind of silly like that. There's the emotional, you know, like strong feeling of emotional love. And then as we grow, we find out that we can love each other without strong, you know, people grow up with misconceptions. Like, love has to be the strong, passionate, emotional feeling. And without it, where did the love go? Oh, the love has died. And actually, there's some. You laughing now. You don't even know what that means. Actually, let me read you something from one of the books Greater Grace put out recently. Talking about the three kinds of love. Eros. Seek intimacy via physical relationship. Be a time when the desire is no more. I will not love you. That's natural motivation of the old heart. Sturgeo. I love you because it's your turn to give me something to me, and you can meet my needs. There will be a day when this won't be the case, and I won't love you anymore in that way. Phileo, I love you because you please me, but one day I will, without a doubt, find something about you that doesn't please me, and I will stop loving you. This is the deficit motivation of the old heart, Eros, Sergeo, Phileo. New heart, agape. I love you because I already have an intimate relationship with God, and I will never stop loving you. How is that even possible? Agape. I love you because God's already met my needs. This will always be the case, always. Never have any reason to stop loving you. Agape. I love you because God is in you, and as He is perfect and doesn't change, I will always love you because of Him inside of you. Motivations of the new heart, based upon love of God, relationship of God in our life. Isn't that amazing? You know, we grow in our concept and idea of love. We think it's I give to you, you give to me, and that's how it works. Come on, guys. It doesn't work. If it worked, it doesn't work. It doesn't work like that. It's got to be God in the marriage or it's not going to work. Here in John 21:15, we learn a little lesson here from Peter. It says this. This is between Peter and Jesus, and Greek is where you get this from, because otherwise it just says love. But we just have one word for love. Why? So when they had dined, 21:15 of John. So when they had dined, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of Jonas, you agape me more than these." And he said to him, "Yeah, Lord, you know that I phileo you. You know, I have a strong feeling of connection toward you. You're like my brother. You're like my family. I phileo you." And then he said to him the second time, "Simon, do you agape me? Do you love me like I love you? Like unconditionally." And he said, "Lord, like, yeah, Lord, you know, I phileo you, like you're my friend, you're my buddy, like, you know, I have a strong emotional, you know, I said I would die for you, even though when it came time I ran off. Like, you know, I have this strong emotional passion for Christ, you know." And then he said to him a third time, "Simon, do you even phileo me?" You can look it up. Peter was grieved because he said unto him the third time, "Do you even phileo me?" And he said, Lord, you know everything. You know that I phileo you. Jesus said unto him, "Feed my sheep." You know, it's funny. Like, you know, here it's like Simon's like this adult child. "Yeah, I kind of love you. You're my guy." And then Christ says, "Okay, do you love me like I love you? I phileo you. No, you're like my buddy. Like, would you, no. Do you even really phileo me?" And that's when he's like, "But you know everything. Yeah, we're like buddies, right?" Like, even here, Peter, needing to grow in his sense of love. I thought there was a cute conversation between the two. "Peter, do you even really phileo me? You know everything, Lord. You know if I don't. And if I do, then great, you know. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Yeah, okay. Be my lambs." We're not getting anywhere with this. Just, you know, be my lamb. No, I was thinking, what is the problem? What is wrong with mankind today? I mean, we could say, okay, they're people. They're, okay, what is wrong with them? We could say, okay, sin. Yeah, that's an easy one. What is wrong with people today? Oh. I mean, so many issues. Like, what is wrong with them? And the antagonist would say, well, why do you have to see a problem with mankind? Like, you should just leave them alone and let them live their own lives, right? Or, you know, I just want to live a peaceful life and coexist with other people and not have a problem with them. I want this to be the way it is. But what the smacks of complacency, uninterest, don't care about what's going on in life. Leave them alone, you know. Yeah, you don't know what it's like to be, you know. Where would I take this? Complacency, yeah. Let me read you the last thing I was going to read you. And this is from, hopefully I have enough time. This is from a book that Pastor Shiloh wrote called Spreading Your Global Wings. Or not, I don't know if there's any physically on Earth anymore, but you can find it on Amazon. Order it, put it on your device. Spreading Your Global Wings, a new look at world missions. And this was a funny section I remember, called Tame the Females and Domesticate the Males. And this was a conversation that Satan was having with his demons about how to counter the actions of the church. Remember, people, relinquishing responsibility is one of our most effective weapons against the archenemy. As was the case with the Jews, who started to build the temples only to quit soon after. Then on the other hand, however, there are those like David and his miserable men, those wretched ones who would stand up in a lintel patch at the threat of losing their lives, unfortunately, rooting us out. Hopefully these types are becoming less common and quite rare among those with whom are dealing. Be sure we keep the males domesticated and keep the courageous ladies at home. The more home-oriented they are, the less possibility of their thinking of adventure. Adventure will come from those dreadful missionary biographies and the life stories of those traveling preachers. Be careful. They read the enemy's handbook. They are convinced that it is quite another error today, and that they can expect nothing like that today. That is easily done in most places by the lulling effect of the droning of the preacher and the sleeping attitude of the people. Oppress the domesticate with the details of life and continually persuade them that they simply cannot live expecting anything but a new toolbox or a new refrigerator. Wow, that really hurts Jesus. I was just talking about a new refrigerator. And that only if they work hard for it. And, of course, the issue here isn't male or female. There have been plenty of exceedingly bold females who have been used mightily by the enemy to prod the sleepy, passive-type male into taking bold action against us. Actually, there have been male-female combinations that have absolutely overrun us. Alone, they'd be sitting ducks, easy targets, but together, they are nearly untouchable. We should keep a tight watch on these couples that are showing interest in consistent church participation. They are extremely dangerous. On the other hand, nothing tickles my fancy more than to see a solid-thinking male become domesticated and tamed by his wife or girlfriend. He fortunately doesn't realize his potential as being one of our enemies. Likewise, many potentially dangerous females are tamed by home-loving males. These males successfully persuade their spouse to stay home and bake cookies for the midweek ball game. Remember, mixed-match marriages are extremely effective. It takes a rare bird to drag his begrudging companion around the world with him or her, or even yet, leave him or her behind. What a thrill to see a vibrant living male subdued by the glaring, manipulating stare of a female, or vice versa. A delightful game. On checkmating a king. Joey. Domesticate the male, tame the female, so they are actually just like the new summer backyard furniture they were just forced to buy. Shiny, new, hollow, and stationary. I read that many times, and it hurt every time I read that. Complacency, passivity, lives, indecisiveness. I found three times in the Old Testament it talks about it. I'll read them, and then we'll close. First one, Deuteronomy chapter 30, says this. Chapter 30, 15 through 20. See that I have set before you this day life and good, and death evil. 30 verse 15. And then I command you this day to love the Lord thy God, to walk in his ways, and to keep his commandments, and his statutes, and his judgments, that thou mayest live and multiply. The Lord thy God shall bless thee in the land whither thou goest to possess it. But if your heart turn away, so that thou wilt not hear, shalt be drawn away, and worship other gods, and serve them, I denounce unto you this day, that you shall surely perish, and that you will not prolong your days unto the land, for that thou passest over Jordan and go to possess it. I call heaven and earth to record this day against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live. Second spot, Joshua 24. Joshua 24:15. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods serve that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites, in whose land you dwell, but as for me and my house, serve the Lord. And the last part, 1 Kings 18. Elijah came unto all the people and said unto them, how long will ye halt between two opinions? If the Lord be God, follow him. If Baal, follow him. People, sadly enough, answered him. These are years apart from each other, and yet it's the same situation, same conflict, generation after generation, time after time after time. Who's? We meet tons of people in outreach. Fence riding, straddling the fence. Indecisive. I don't know about this. I don't want to jump too quickly in it because I could be, complacent, passive. Not willing to make a decision. They're just, I mean, it is like one of the sickest attitudes to find in individuals. You know, this passivity. For God motivating us all the day long. Choose love. Choose life. Choose God's way in life. Amen. So we have enough time for a song.